My guest today is Joseph Layton, who is a fellow at the Wilson Center's Media Studies Project. Joe Layton, welcome to Radio Dialogue. I guess more properly, welcome back to Radio Dialogue.
Nice to be here, George.
Joe, last time when I gave you your full introduction, it was about three paragraphs long and we focused on Washington. I could do the same today and we're going to focus on Hollywood. I mentioned all your Washington credentials in our previous conversation, and let me just, for the benefit of our listeners, tell them of some of the things you did while you were in Hollywood from 1953 to 1963. During that decade, you were a journalist with the Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, Ladies Home Journal, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, among many others, I'm sure. You hosted a radio program. You interviewed many, many stars. So those are pretty impressive credentials, Joe, to talk about what I call America's other capital, Hollywood, California.
You certainly make them sound impressive, George.
Well, they are, Joe. They really are. I mentioned just in passing that I consider Hollywood America's other capital, and that's not entirely frivolous on my part. I think that you and I are sitting right now in the political capital of our country. But if I had to pick a spot where the capital of our fancy and our fantasy and imagination is, it would clearly be Hollywood, California.
You know, they're not so far apart, Washington and Hollywood. I would say the main difference between those two capitals is the choice of weapons. In Washington, the main weapon is a scalpel, and in Hollywood, it's a meat cleaver.
Jim, should I take it that the meat cleaver is sometimes planted firmly in someone's back?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, goodness. Your period there, Joe, 53 to 63, might have been one of the high periods of this kind of internecine warfare. Hollywood was at it, if not its peak, it was certainly a very, very powerful force in those days. Could you sort of start out by telling us a bit what it was like?
Well, those were the receding days, actually, of Hollywood, when everybody I talked to was already talking about the good old days. And during that period, the stars really were beginning to take over the whole operation. The studios had almost become like rental installations. Hmm. And as a matter of fact, what was taking place was a little bit the way Samuel Goldwyn described it once, when somebody woke him up. He owned United Artists Studio, and somebody woke him up one day and said, you know, the movie stars have bought out the studio. And he said, my God, the inmates have taken over the asylum.
Joe, that transition's pretty fascinating to me, though, because you mentioned Goldwyn, and you mentioned the fact that the stars in the 1950s were beginning to run the operation, in a sense. Mr. Goldwyn is kind of the prototypical mogul, in my mind. What caused that transition? What led from this, the age of the great studio and the stable and the star belonging to the studio, to the star taking over the show?
For one thing, the courts had ruled that the studios had to dispense with the theaters. They could no longer own the theaters. Mm-hmm. And for many, many years, the studios produced movies just to fill the program menus in all their theaters. Mm. That was the first step. The second was, of course, television movie,
yes.
That was the real menace.
Uh-huh.
And that coaxial cable that at that time was, as they put it, creeping across the continent,
uh-huh,
and approaching Hollywood for a complete circuit. They were really worried about the day it would reach Hollywood, which would complete the continental circuit. And what it did, actually, what nobody had figured on, it began to force them to make better movies.
Good, that's interesting. You know, we're both too young to remember it, but was the effect of television on Hollywood anything like the effect of the talkies on movies? I mean, was it that?
It was bigger.
Bigger.
The impact, uh-huh, was much greater.
Uh-huh.
I think another turning point is when the studios decided that in digging in, you know, for, mm-hmm, what they thought was going to be a recession, their income, they decided not to keep all these stars on their payrolls. So each star became an independent operator, which reduced the overhead of the studios. But all of a sudden, it cost them millions right up front to hire an actor like Jimmy Stewart,
right,
whereas before they had him on, you know, on a salary.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, it was really not very far-sighted thinking on the studio's part.
Yeah, you know, Joe, as we sit here and focus back on that decade, the 50s, essentially, when you were in Hollywood, the era we're talking about, I think you are absolutely, as usual, quite right in saying that television was a fundamental force in changing the nature of the industry. Let me ask you about another somewhat different kind of force that you also witnessed here in Washington, later out there. And that was the kind of political atmosphere of that era, perhaps just a bit before the 50s, early 50s, late 40s. I'm thinking particularly of Senator McCarthy. I'm thinking of the advent of the kind of political trauma the country went through, with a particular effect on the entertainment industry and a very particular effect on Hollywood. How did you assess all that?
Well, look, they were, in spite of McCarthy, they were putting out some interesting pictures. Stanley Kramer, you know, was making some pictures with a social message, and although he would deny it, he used to say, you know, you want a message, call Western Union. he made that picture with Tony Curtis and Sidney
Poitier. The defiant ones.
You know, which was kind of, for its time, was quite a...
I remember that.
A picture to suggest, you know, that the black and white could live, you know, in perfect harmony. It might be a little corny today, in today's sophisticated world, but at that time it was quite a daring thing to do, and he did it quite well. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of other films, you know, like that.
Right.
McCarthy, you know, had quite an impact out in Hollywood, like he had every place else. People got scared, and they get a lot more scared in Hollywood than they do any place else.
Sure, it affects money, among other things.
Yeah. But I mean, now television is that way.
Right. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you right away at the start of our conversation, what took you out there in the first place?
I happened to be in Arizona. I was editing a weekly newspaper there because I wanted to get the experience of publishing one, because I really had an idea of starting one here in Washington. A friend of mine in Los Angeles asked me to come out there and have dinner with him when I finished the job, and I went there, and he was the West Coast editor of Collier's. He said, listen, he said, we're planning a cover story on Marlene Dietrich. He said, and we're looking for somebody who doesn't know anything about Hollywood to do the, to write it and research it. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, that sounds rather intriguing. So I stayed there to do this cover story on Marlene Dietrich and stayed for 10 years. Not with her, but I mean with...
What, I guess I better ask this right away. What was that like, that experience of doing a cover story on someone as fascinating and covered in mystery as Marlene Dietrich is for most of us?
Well, it was a marvelous way to learn about Hollywood through her, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. And she finally found out that I was working on the story, and she arranged for her lawyer to call me to find out what was going on, you know. And he called, and I said I didn't know it was against the law for me to go around asking questions about Marlene Dietrich. And he said, well, look, he said, I'm authorized to give you her unlisted phone number. Mm-hmm. Will you please call? I said, if you want me to call her? I was planning to leave her to the last, you know. Anyway, I called her, and I said, well, if you'd like to see me now, it's all right. I was planning to leave you to the last. And she said, I'm too busy to see you. Well, this went on for 2 solid hours on the phone telling me she had no time to see me until finally we made the appointment, you know.
It sounds to me, of course, she made the appointment, and then I imagine she kept up with the work that you were doing on her story. She made sure that it came out, or at least that you talked to people that she wanted you to talk to about it.
Well, we had a little problem there. When we finally did meet, she told me that I was talking to all the wrong people about her, and I rather delicately said, you know, Ms. Dietrich, I wouldn't presume to tell you how to act. I don't think you ought to tell me how to research a story about yourself. And she says, apparently you're interested in doing a very conscientious job on me, which nobody else has ever done. And, you know, there are 5 people that you can't do a real story about my life without talking to them. And I said, Ms. Dietrich, you give me their names, and I promise you that I will attempt to talk to those people. So she gave me the names, and that would have made a story in itself, because each person I called, these are all prominent people, I would leave a message saying, I'm doing the research on an article about Marlene Dietrich, and she told me that I couldn't do an article about her life without talking to 5 people. You're one of them. And the doors flew open. Mm-hmm. I mean, Alfred Hitchcock stopped directing Rear Window, had me on the set while he talked to me, and he said, yes, I'll see you, but you've got to come to the set, and you know, and I'll be glad to talk to you. When they were redoing the lighting on the set, he came over, he said, are you sure that she said that you couldn't write a story without talking to 5 people, and that I was one of them? And I said, yes, you directed her in a picture. He said, yes, but it was, if you look at the picture very closely, we were able to shoot all her scenes out of context in 1 or 2 days, so I really never got to know her, and as a matter of fact, I really don't know her.
Goodness.
Now, But that time, Alfred Hitchcock was the hottest director in Hollywood. She wanted to be identified
with him.
Mm-hmm. And I was able to quote him. I said, well, look, what do you think of her as an actress? He said, well, she's not much of an actress, he says, but by God, when she's up there on the screen, there's no hole in that screen.
That's quite a tribute.
Yes, indeed.
Joe, is that kind of cultivation of image, of one's persona, film persona, a commonplace among the great actors and actresses in Hollywood?
I don't know about all of them, but as far as Marlene Dietrich was concerned, it was a full-time occupation.
Joe, I have taken the liberty of doing something that I hope you will agree to. It's quite a departure for Radio Dialogue. I've listened to some of the tapes from this very vast archive that you have of interviews which you did with stars during that era. You did them for radio, I think a program that you had called Flair, among several others. And as I say, it's a vast archive indeed, it's an historical treasure. And what I've done, Joe, is take a few excerpts from it, which I'd like to play for you right now, bring those lives, those voices back before us, and get your reaction, both in a sort of a then and now sense, to the stars. Would you flatter me in doing that?
Yeah.
Let's hear this first excerpt. This is an actor I think known to many millions of Americans, certainly every generation up to now, Mr. Pat O'Brien, who you interviewed, and you got him to do something that I don't think that he very often did.
Incidentally, Pat, what's your favorite Irish song?
My favorite? Well, I have a lot of favorites, but I have one. I sang it on the Ed Sullivan Show some years ago. And a song my father used to sing to me many years. I used to sing it to my children when they were younger. It has no title. It goes back, I guess hundreds of years. It's Chip, Chip, my little horse, Chip, Chip again, sir. How many miles to Dublin town? 80, sir. Chip, Chip, my little horse, Chip, Chip again, sir. Can I get there be candlelight? Are you cannon back again, sir? That's one of my favorites, I think.
That's a very lovely song.
Yeah, and you won't.
What does that bring back, Joe? First of all, when did you do that, I guess?
It was on St. Patrick's Day. And it just occurred, it was a completely spontaneous thing. It was on some set, or it was home, I forget, but it was on St. Patrick's Day, which is why I was interviewing Pat O'Brien, as a matter of fact. And I've loved him ever since I saw him in The Front Page, if you remember, where he played Hildy Johnson, the reporter, and he became my childhood hero because I wanted to become a newspaper man just like him, And but he was such a charmer, and I remember he invited me to have lunch with him, and but he didn't tell me that he was on a diet, so the lunch was a little can of Metrical, one of those. The two of us had lunch, each holding a little can of Metrical.
Is he as charming as he seems to be in that excerpt?
He's not only charming, he's himself. Uh-huh. And I was indeed very sorry to know of his passing some years ago.
One other comment on him that occurred to me very much as I listened to this. You had and I must pay you this compliment on the air, as it were, an uncanny ability, Joe, to bring out things in people that I think that they, not in the question of them wanting to conceal, but they would not necessarily have revealed so readily.
George, one of the things I used to do, I used to take, which most interviewers in Hollywood didn't do, I used to take chances. And sometimes it didn't work out. There was one star that almost hauled off and slugged me.
Dare I ask?
I'll tell you off,
you don't want to
off
take that
mic,
chance?
I'll tell you who it was. He was really teed off. And only because I asked him what his real name was. sometimes we would draw a blank, and on a couple of occasions, like this one with Pat O'Brien, it would strike a little note. Another time when I really took a chance was with Jimmy Durante. And again, he either could have hauled off and socked me or would have produced a wonderful interview, and I think it was one of the best interviews I ever had, where I said to him, I mentioned to a psychiatrist that I was going to interview Jimmy Durante. And the psychiatrist says, it's always been my theory that the reason Jimmy Durante has made a career out of making jokes about his nose is that actually he's very sensitive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that to Durante. There's a long pause. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me, he said, that psychiatrist friend of yours, he's absolutely right. And he began telling me about his childhood days when he would always get beaten up by the other kids because of his nose. And one day he made a joke about the nose and everybody laughed with him. And he said, I've been making jokes about it ever since.
That's fascinating.
He's because I don't like getting beaten up.
You know, Joe, as usual, you've just set me up admirably for the next next thing I'm about to do. Because I chose, as our very next selection to listen to, an interview where you indeed did take a risk, and where you did something I don't think that very many people did with the subject of the interview. The subject is Jimmy Stewart, one of the great icons of American cinema, American culture, we might as well say.
Yes, indeed.
And you have asked him a question, which I don't think he got asked very often, and he gave an answer, which clearly set him thinking. And let's listen to it again and see what you think about it.
I'd like to hear it myself.
You know, there's one question I've always wanted to ask you, Mr. Stewart, a sort of a longish question, which probably calls for a short answer. You know, here you are, just about one of the most successful motion picture actors in the world. You're rich, you're married to a beautiful woman, you have a wonderful family, you've made general in the Air Force, you're a member of the Board of Trustees of Princeton University, you're an outstanding member of the community. Now, what I'd like to know is, in the name of humanitarianism, could you please tell us, don't you have any frustrations?
Well, you said it'd be a short answer. I imagine it's got to be a short answer, because I don't know exactly how to answer it. All in all, I don't think I have many frustrations. Probably one of them is the fact that I'm getting old, but that's
like all of us.
That's something that isn't just in my case. The frustrations are that I'm getting old, I can't play all the parts that come up in movies, or I can't start out directing right away, or this is frustrating. But of course, when you sit right down and go over the thing with yourself, it's not frustration because it's inevitable.
That has a kind of a haunting feel to it, Joe. First
you know,
of all,
that's interesting. I haven't heard that since that
when did you do that, by the way?
I would say it was about between 25 and 30 years ago.
Goodness. And he would only have been about 52 then. He's 82 right now. Yeah. He was already that's what really struck me, that he had that feeling then.
What, you know, I haven't listened to this.
Exactly. That's the whole advantage of this.
And when I listen, really, what really impresses me is that he made an honest, sincere effort to give me an honest answer.
That's right.
Which a lot of the movie stars out there would not have, they would have been flip about it, you know, or told me it was none of my business, or what kind of a stupid question is that, or, you know. But he obviously was making an earnest effort to examine his own thoughts, which he apparently had never thought about too much.
Yeah. The next selection I've got for us, Joe, is one of the great talents, not just of Hollywood, but of Broadway. Another monument, if you will, in human form, Ethel Merman. And I think this is a very charming little interlude. I just couldn't resist putting this in just to get, to let the listeners know, Joe has not heard these in decades, mm-hmm. I don't think. So there's that element of surprise.
She's quite a marvelous woman.
She certainly was. And let's listen to her again right here talking to Joe Layton.
Broadway musical comedy star Ethel Merman, to nobody's surprise, is a big hit in Las Vegas, her first nightclub engagement. First night at the Flamingo, Ethel Merman came on stage and said, I don't know what I'm doing here, but singing songs is my business, so here we go, and go she did. Ethel Merman, who has never been in a flop, was recently called the star with a 50-megaton voice. But sometime before the atomic bomb was invented, the great composer Toscanini said Ethel Merman's voice just wasn't human. What say about that, Ethel?
Well, is it? It's done wonders for me. I've never taken a singing lesson, so I say I think it's.
Can't you read music either?
Oh yes, I read music. Yes, I read. Never left from school, yeah. But I've never taken a singing lesson. I've never taken a dramatic lesson. I've never taken a diction lesson, and I feel this way that the people that go all out to acquire these wonderful points are, if they haven't got it to begin with, something inwardly, basically, I don't think they'll ever achieve it. I think you've got to have some sort of a foundation there to begin with.
You know, you said in your autobiography that from the stage you don't sell sex. Well, I call it sex. What do you call it?
That never entered my mind, as a matter of fact. I thought I was just sort of selling talent.
Listening to it again, Joe, after all these decades, do you still think it was sex that she was projecting up there on stage, or... or talent, as she says.
It was a contagious vitality that she projected. And also, as I was listening to that, it made me aware of the fact that I always found that actors or actresses who were essentially stage people were entirely different for interviews than the movie people were. Far better, as a matter of fact. You sort of got canned answers from a lot of the people in the, except the big stars like Jimmy Stewart, but I mean the run-of-the-mill people. But the stage people were always, shall I use the word more intelligent? Maybe that's what I really mean. They were just a different breed of cat.
Well, it was one explanation that occurs to me. Were they simply used to speaking for themselves? I mean, an actor, I think of a studio and his publicity agent and this agent and that agent sort of surrounding him or her and sort of telling them what they should be doing in any given.
That undoubtedly was a part of it, and I think that people on from the stage were accustomed to they changed the role a little bit. You know, you can't do the same thing every night. They were trying to perfect the role, whereas people in the movies, first of all, they had to have what I would call celluloid magic. That was the beginning of it, and the rest sort of would be helpful if you could act. You know.
Joe, the final selection I've chosen for our conversation today is someone who I think is right in this tradition we're talking about, who projects this kind of magnetism, if you will, on the screen. And I want to get from you a sense of whether he did that in person as well. And we're going to roll a very brief segment of your conversation years ago with Yul Brynner.
There's one particular question I have in mind, Mr. Brynner, and it has to do with the coming national elections. At various times, actors have taken a great deal of interest in national politics and affairs, and sometimes have been outspoken on behalf of certain candidates. And I would like to know how you feel about actors taking active part in national affairs and politics.
Well, I don't believe in it very much, and I'll tell you exactly why. We as actors have a certain amount of following which we achieve on our artistic merits. I think that if we go into politics and try to bring that following of ours and make them follow us to our political aims, we're abusing our privileges as artists. And I think also that we are not doing any good politically either, because only fools are going to follow an actor in his politics.
I guess you know why I picked that one, Joe. I couldn't resist the irony of that.
Yeah. You know, while I was listening, I was thinking about something else, about what the high points for me were. And there's one little thing that occurred, and this is actually before I went out to Hollywood, but I was interviewing Katharine Hepburn with seven other male reporters, you know. And one of the things, the highlights of my professional life, is when she put, in the middle of the interview, she pulled out a cigarette, and all of us pulled out matches, and I beat everybody to the light, which reminds me of what Dorothy Parker said about women like Katharine Hepburn, that when they pull out a cigarette, they start a prairie fire around them. I was so proud of myself for that. This is not to be considered a wholesale endorsement of smoking, however.
How about Mr. Brynner?
Oh, he was a fascinating man. It was a pleasure to talk to him. As you can see from that excerpt, the whole interview would go on that way, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it went on for about an hour. I just couldn't stop. And he was enjoying it. And very often, you know, when an actor was enjoying the interview, it was because he was responding. He wasn't giving canned answers, or his press agent hadn't done it.
Joe, we sit here at a Center for Scholars having a terrific time, you and I talking about an era that's more than an era of entertainment, it's an era of American history. For some reason, I can't get out of my mind that phrase, that title of that song, Hooray for Hollywood. We've all heard that a thousand times, maybe a million times by now. I've never been there, but it certainly affected my life and the life of just about everyone else I know. As someone who has, and who can look back on that era, and of course has looked at this one as well, what's your assessment of all? Should we really be saying hooray for Hollywood? Has it been a positive, powerful? It has been a powerful, but has it also been a positive force in American life, and does it continue to be?
Indeed. I think there was a period of time in our history when Hollywood was setting our foreign policy, practically, that Hollywood films had more of an impact on people abroad and the heads of state than anything our State Department ever put out. Mm-hmm. And there was no question about that. And to a certain degree, that went on. Well, it went on for at least one or two decades. And I think the government probably was not unaware of that. I mean, Hollywood was our ambassador abroad, and people got some strange images of what this country was all about as a result of that. But it also sort of it became a mecca for people, you know, to come here. And Hollywood could also, in those days, do a lot of damage, you know, in the kind of films they made. But that's why they had such strict censorship rules then. As a matter of fact, you know, I did a radio documentary for CBS on, it was an hour-long documentary on whether Hollywood could survive television. And in the course of doing this hour-long documentary, there were two words used in that documentary. And one was abortion, and the other was whore. And it was the first time the word abortion and whore had ever been used on radio. And I was using those words to demonstrate how both those words incidentally were taken from the soundtracks of two recent films at that time. One, the word abortion was taken from 10 North Frederick with Gary Cooper and Diane Varsi, and the word whore was taken out of the Hemingway picture, Farewell to Arms, with Rock Hudson and Jennifer Jones, you see. And I was using that to demonstrate how far censorship had come in Hollywood to permit those two words to be used. And in using them in my program, it was the first time they'd ever been used on radio. We've come a long way, baby.
We sure have, Joe. Joe, I've got to thank you for this interview. I almost feel like saying thanks for the memories, Joe Layton. It's just been fantastic.
Can you sing it, Joe?
I'll try to.
This program is dedicated to the memory of Joseph Layton, a former fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler, our production engineer is Anthony Barber, and our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.